Okay. Good morning. It is 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and we are in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room, 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck. For the record, this is Tony Clark, Commission Chairman.
Kevin Kramer, good morning. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
And Brian Culk, good morning. And also just want to send along my thoughts to Senator Tom Fisher's family. I had the opportunity to represent the commission yesterday at the funeral in Fargo. There was a lot of legislators there, a full house at Nativity Church, and you know, just one of those things that happened, but it was a very good turnout and a lot of good thoughts about Tom. And Attorney General Wayne Stengen did a very good job at the end of the funeral and just a really good turnout there yesterday. So our thoughts are with Tom and his family.
Absolutely. With that, we have a few items on consent.
I'd move passage of consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Moving to items in my portfolio, TC1, I move the commission deem the application complete, conditioned on filing, on receiving final turbine locations at least 1 week prior to hearing, and issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in the application of Wilton Wind 4, LLC, for a certificate of site compatibility to authorize construction of a proposed 99-megawatt Wilton 4 Wind Energy Center in Burley County, North Dakota, case number PU-11-646.
Second.
There are a few things that the company will need to turn in before the hearing itself, but otherwise the application is complete and it deals with the typical things that we get prior to the hearing, but that may not be done at the application phase, like the micro-siting of the turbines themselves, so on and so forth. This, if the motions are out on the table, I don't recall if this one has been laid out or not, but there is a map that indicates where the proposed wind farm would be. It's just north and a little east of Bismarck.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC2, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a siting application to 30 days and assess a filing fee of $100,000 due upon filing an application in case number PU-11-662, Elite Inc.'s proposed 100-megawatt clean energy number one wind project in Mercer and Morton counties of North Dakota.
Second.
This is probably not a big surprise to anyone, being the motion that we had a few weeks ago, which related to a 230 kV transmission line that is proposed to be built in this area for, as we indicated at the time, Elite Clean Energy, which is a subdivision of Elite or Minnesota Power. This is a merchant operation that they're starting, which basically would produce power and then sell it to other utilities. And as indicated in the filing, Elite intends to, would like to obtain commission approval and by the winter of 2012.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Culk.
Good morning. Item BK1. I move the commission issue a notice of filing, notice of hearing, and notice of intervention deadline for Otter Tail Power Company's application for a transmission cost recovery rate, case number PU-11-153, and a transmission cost recovery tariff, case number PU-11682.
Second.
On May of this last year, November of this last year, Otter Tail Power Company filed for approval to implement a transmission cost recovery rider pursuant to the appropriate law. Basically, this rider is for transmission facility rates not currently included in base rates. Petitions to intervene will be accepted till January 14th, and we have a formal hearing scheduled for January 24th of next year, 2012, right here in the commission room.
We actually already have interveners in this case, as I recall, the large industrial group that has come together for previous Otter Tail cases that include a lot of folks in that Wahpeton area, like Goodridge and Prime Wood and Comdell, and then Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, Cavendish Farms in the Jamestown area. So there's clearly a lot of interest in how we recover costs for this transmission, and it's a little bit of a switch from tradition. So appropriate that we would have some interveners.
And there are four different, actually, customer classes that are defined, so it'll be interesting, as Kevin pointed out, how this all unfolds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that concludes the items in my portfolio.
Just one. I move the Commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and citing application to 30 days, and assess a filing fee of $30,000 due upon filing of an application in case number PU11683, One Oak Rockies Midstream LLC's proposed 12.4-mile, 10-inch natural gas liquids pipeline in Williams County, North Dakota.
Second.
This is a natural gas liquids line that's proposed to take the liquids from the State Line 1 and State Line 2 processing facilities, which we cited earlier this year and are under construction right now in Williams County. Each of them is a 100,000 MCF per day processing plant. And you may recall that earlier, or I guess last year, we cited the Garden Creek plant, which is near Watford City, and the pipeline that takes the liquids from there to a Richland County facility for loading on trains. Well, this owned by the same company in Williams County, will do the same thing. It'll take the NGLs from State Line. This is a longer line, but it's only about 12.4 miles of the pipeline will be in North Dakota. The rest will be in Montana, and we'll conclude at Bainville, Montana, at the Riverview Trail Terminal, which is owned, as I said earlier, by One Oak. It's in total 53.4 miles, 12.4 being located in North Dakota. It's 10.75-inch pipe. The state line projects are both, as I said earlier, under construction, and the construction timeline for this line is to be in sync with that, so they expect to have it completed by about August of next year, which is the time when the first State Line 1 will be done, and then State Line 2 is expected to be completed and producing gas by the end of next year. The total cost of this project is anticipated to be just over $6 million.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And this is the items in my portfolio.
All right, very good. Announcements are listed. We do have an informal hearing scheduled today for 1:30 with Bearpaw Energy LLC, Garden Creek to Riverview NGL Pipeline, McKenzie Siting Application. We have a formal hearing scheduled before our next regular commission meeting on next Tuesday, November 29th. The commission's beginning at 8:30 here in the commission hearing room. We'll be hearing the Montana-Dakota Utility Company's advanced determination of prudence Big Stone air application, which is also we will be hearing at the same time Ottertail Power's advanced termination of prudence. Of course, it's the same project of a plant that both utilities participate in. And our next commission meeting is Wednesday, December 7th. Tuesday, December 6th, we have our quarterly Lignite Energy Council meeting. It's double up.
So as to not confuse people by the fact that we are having an informal this afternoon on Bear Power, One Oaks, previously cited NGL line, that's because there was a slight deviation requested as a result of a landowner request.
All right. With that, are there any questions?
Wilton Wind 4, how close is it to the current wind farms?
It's quite close. I don't know if adjacent would exactly be the right word or not, but it's very similar location. It's just south of Regan. That would be the closest town. I don't think I noted when I went through the motion. They did list the proposed, how much they thought it would cost. Why am I not seeing it? Oh, that was the Elite project. Never mind.
And the Elite project will cost how much?
Thanks for asking, Dave. Which you'd never ask. The Elite project is projected to cost $200 million, depending on final project design and turbine selection.
And you said that was the term you used was, it's not retail?
Merchant power plant.
Merchant power plant.
Right, which it just means that they're doing it as a business venture, not for their own regulated utility, but rather to sell to other utility companies.
Yeah, it was interesting because as we were citing the Bison 1, 2, and 3 projects, which were for Minnesota Power to be used as part of their rate base and for their own customers. The capacity on the transmission line was always a curiosity to us because, you know, clearly there's a lot more capacity than these three, and given the production tax credit expiration date of next year, you wondered what are they going to do, and lo and behold, they formed an independent power producer, and as Tony said, to become a merchant. There's obviously a great demand in Minnesota as long as that mandate remains in place, and they have tremendous assets, including a tremendous wind asset in North Dakota, and so taking advantage of all that to go into business.
I assume they have not identified potential customers.
They have not to us, anyway.
No, they haven't. In fact, in their application, they indicate that the timing of the project and decision to move forward will be dependent on finding a counterparty to enter into a contract for purchase of the power.
I was thinking Xcel.
I bet they are, too, but who knows?
Do you know offhand now how much wind generation is either up and running or approved?
Well, up and running, it's about 1,400 megawatts. Jerry, have there been additions to that that I'm not thinking of?
That's pretty close, but I can get you the exact numbers.
Yeah, we've got this spreadsheet. So. Yeah.
And how does that compare with coal?
Well, it's still less than is produced by coal in the state, but it's a significant percentage. If you look at states, this data may be a few months old, but it gives you an indication of how much wind power is produced in North Dakota. North Dakota is number two in the nation with regard to percentage of generating capacity that comes from renewables, primarily wind. I think it's about 15%. We're still in an overwhelmingly coal state, about 85%, but that's down from probably about 98% coal prior to the advent of the wind industry. If you looked at it, installed capacity, in other words, in a day when the wind is blowing and all those resources are being used to their fullest extent, it's much larger than that. But in terms of energy, it's about 15%, which places us number two in the nation in terms of percentage of power derived from renewables, second only to Iowa.
If you kind of round the numbers out, for nameplate capacity, we have nameplate capacity of roughly 4,500 megawatts coal generation and 1,500 megawatts of wind generation, which would put wind at 25% of the nameplate capacity. As you know, Tony points out, of course, the wind doesn't blow all of the time, and so in terms of actual energy generated, it would be a much smaller percentage.
Ask a quick question about the transmission facility cost recovery rates. What is different about this?
Well, as far as that, there's going to be four different customer classes. And this, the particular tariff is inside MISO Schedule 26. So this is a tariff that is something that's outside of base rates that, as they go forward, I think with the relationship of MISO and these different customer classes, it's probably the first time we've done something this integrated, if you will.
I think what the company's looking to do is to sort of separate out the overbuild of the transmission lines so that that percentage or that
try to find
capacity
the right mix
that's outside of just North Dakota's ratepayers' needs would be entitled, or they would try to get a rate of return from FERC as opposed to from the state of North Dakota, from the Public Service Commission, which is a higher rate. So it comes with it some fairly complex economics and allocation issues that will have to be worked through through what I guess would be a pretty rigorous hearing schedule.
Is this related all to CapEx 2020?
I don't know that it does.
I wouldn't think directly, but indirectly, I think there's going to be definitely some things that come across. What I think is interesting is we already, the interveners, they intervened in our previous rate case, and now with the different customer classes of rates, the way it's scheduled right now, the large general services is the highest rate. So, the larger companies will be potentially paying more, and I can see this becoming very interesting by the time we're done.
One further question about and it's based on your One Oak and the natural gas line. I suppose you saw the New York Times article a few months ago about the flaring of gas.
Yes.
It's about 30%, they say.
It is.
You don't directly regulate flaring of gas.
No, we do not. The Industrial Commission does.
Do you think North Dakota is making progress in getting that amount of flared gas,
yes,
down below 30%.
Well, it should get down to single digits, I would hope, and not the least of which, because even at $3.50 a MCF, natural gas production is actually quite profitable right now, because, especially in the Bakken, because of course it is a secondary product. It's already the oil guys are drilling it. Dave, what I think you're going to see, and I think we'll start seeing it rather soon, the Garden Creek facility near Watford City, which is a One Oak facility, 100,000 MCF per day, will be going online pretty much any day now. Once that happens, once the One Oak, the Garden Creek line goes on, that's 100,000 MCF per day that will be no longer flared but processed. State Line 1 and 2, as I said, State Line 1 is expected to go online in August of next year. State Line 2, by the end of next year, you have the Hess facility with its going from 100 to 250,000 MCF per day. A number of smaller ones, we just noticed, or maybe we just approved, I don't even remember anymore, a pipeline for Highland, which is a smaller 50,000 MCF per day. So when those facilities all get online and we start are able to get that gas into the market stream, I think we'll see it rather quickly come down. It's just that right now it's so much. At 30%, it's so much. As I stated earlier, that represents enough gas to heat 1,000 North Dakota homes for 1 year every day. Every day the gas that we flare could heat 1,000 North Dakota homes for a year. So we look at it from that standpoint, we think, my goodness, that's immoral. But investors look at it and say, my goodness, that's money that's being, you know, burned into the air as well. So we're seeing the companies step up. It's just that lag between the oil production, which creates the flaring, and then the gathering and processing and marketing infrastructure to move that gas along that has created this hopefully very temporary issue.
For me, one of the most rewarding aspects of this job right now is with regard to facility siting for pipelines and these processing plants for oil and for gas, because it's a solution, right? I mean, we don't regulate the exploration and production, and the flaring is really an exploration production regulation issue. But people in the western part of the state are really looking for solutions. How do you get trucks off the road? How do we quit flaring so much natural gas? So on and so forth. And the answer is pipelines, it's processing facilities. And I think the Commission's done an admirable job of trying to process these in an expeditious manner, because that is the safest answer. It's the easiest answer to getting solutions to a lot of the problems that people in the western part of the state are seeing. And we're seeing a lot of investment in that. And I'm just very encouraged by the applications that have been brought with us, as well as the work of this staff in attempting to process those in an expeditious manner, so that pipeline and those facilities can get in the ground quickly but safely.
I met with the CEO of One Oak recently, last week actually, John Gibson, and his COO Terry Spencer and a number of their executive team, and I said, you know, the nice thing about being you is you're on the side of the angels in North Dakota. You're the like the guys in the white hats, because you're coming in to solve this problem. And the challenge that we have is, right now, the biggest challenge for the companies is the gathering system and the right-of-way negotiations and easements, because there's a great deal of landowner fatigue out there. And so to the degree we can sort of encourage landowners and say, look, we know this is getting tiresome and burdensome, but we need cooperation. And that includes the counties and the townships, who are just clearly sort of worn out with all of this. It's important to sort of shore them all up so that they realize that their cooperation is necessary to solve these challenges that Tony was talking about, of trucks on the road and the flaring especially.
Yeah. I mean, once those wells get permitted and once they start producing, that oil, that gas has got to go somewhere. It's either going to be flared in the case of gas, and in the case of oil, it's either going to hit a collector system, a gathering system, and move out, or it's going to go on truck. And that's where the pipeline infrastructure comes in. So it is a solution to a real problem that exists.
I always got to put my plug in for pipeline safety. We're putting all these pipelines in the ground, and pipeline safety, actually later in this morning session, we're going to be talking about some of that cases. But it's great getting all the pipelines in the ground, but make sure they're utilizing call before you dig and all those kind of things, because pipeline safety is a second component of this. Once we get them in the ground, we got to make sure that other folks putting more infrastructure in the ground aren't hitting those along the way.
So in light of the Keystone XL delays, since we have Keystone coming through North Dakota, are you satisfied now with how Keystone's been as far as a good environmental steward?
The biggest incident we had was, of course, the Ludden pumping station, and it was a significant incident. At the same time, I was personally generally pleased with the response time of the company. When you look at the amount that was spilled, and it was a pumping station failure, it was not a pipeline failure, which is an important thing to understand. But the information that we've received thus far has indicated that the response was quite expeditious and the cleanup was fairly thorough. Now we're going to continue to follow up on that, and we should continue to do so. But for every malfunction that occurs on a pipeline or its system or the pumping stations, I'm always reminded that the other option for that oil is some other less safe form of transportation, right? So, I mean, we all saw, for example, what had happened with the pumping station on Keystone. About that same time, there was an oil tanker that went off a road. I think it might have been up in the northeast part of the state that spilled far more oil than it was spilled in the Ludden pumping station incident. So, but no one really focused in on an oil tanker going off the road because it was a vehicle accident, and we are sort of used to hearing about that. And so I think what sometimes makes the oil incidents more noteworthy is that they are fairly rare, fortunately, but they get more attention when they happen. But let's not forget that statistically, by far, it's the most efficient and safest method of moving products that the country needs.
The one thing that impressed me about the Ludden example that Tony points to was we know that accidents are going to happen at some point. There will be some malfunction someplace. You know, life is not perfect, but it's the response to that has to be appropriate. And I think in the case of Keystone and TransCanada, that the response to the Ludden accident or mishap was clearly appropriate. But even more important than that was that all of the safeguards that were put in place worked. The alarm system, the valve shut off, the berms that contained the vast majority of the oil on site, and even the fact that they prepared local landowners to be on the lookout and had phone numbers to call. It all worked the way it's designed to work in case something happens that you don't want to have happen. But things happen. And so far, so good with regard to that. And then the fact that they followed up by replacing every single part, similar part, all along the pipeline. And, I think they've done a good job of it. And I, at the same time, I have to say that, I understand the folks in Nebraska's concern about the XL, their aquifer. It's their state. It's their aquifer. They're concerned, and they ought to have something to say about it, and they have had something to say about it. Now, in the meantime, we still need we want to become less dependent on dictators for our oil, and I'd certainly like to see that XL built sometime sooner rather than later.
Dave, we've had some hearings up in Watford City that the last while, and one of the things the questions that I ask a lot of, we all ask, is that, and they have these response plans, and I think down in Ludden it worked out the way it was supposed to. But one of the concerns I have is that the winters get pretty harsh, and so you have this plan on the shelf. And when it comes time to exercise the plan in January when it's 20 below, that it actually we're able to have the equipment in the right place. And that's one of the things I know the news has been following a lot about, just the response for vehicle accidents, getting enough emergency responders out there. And so that's one thing that the companies I know are working together and some of the county emergency managers. But I think we've got the right plans in place. The question is, do those plans hold together in the extreme weather conditions? And that's, typically when something's going to go wrong, it seems like it goes wrong on the coldest, windiest day of the year. And so that's why it's so important that we can isolate those systems and at least control it. But I guess that would be the one concern I have going forward, is that we've thought through the differences in these plans that, the oil companies, they work throughout the world. But, making sure they've got a plan that's unique enough to North Dakota to be able to respond to somewhere in Watford City, where west of there, where you're in some big valley, deep draw. And I think when they build these systems, a lot of the questions that we ask are making sure they put extra engineering features in place when they cover some of those systems so they've got those extra protections, double walling of pipe and things like that.
Maybe they can look to FEMA for an example. I didn't mean
that. An example not to do?
There's no sarcasm at all there, David.
But that's a good point, though. One size doesn't fit all.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Thank you.
All right. I wish we could give you more. I know you have a long weekend.
Yeah. Lots of time to build.
You always cover Bison in football, the number 2 seed in the FCS championship run.
And where are they playing?
We're off this week. Then we play the winner of, I can't even remember. Doesn't matter who we play, Dave. Same result.
Okay. With that, we will close the meeting. We'll have order signing and return at 10:40.